border security that's also consistent with our values. Number two, you need to deal with the root causes of illegal immigration from the countries of Honduras, Salvador, and Guatemala. And then number three, you need to do exactly as he has done, which is put a comprehensive immigration reform proposal before the Congress so they can grapple with this issue, which has been frustrating our country for far too long.
The refugees and asylum seekers often embark on a lengthy journey to get to the United States. Many recount being kidnapped several times and released only after paying the cartels a ransom.
Corrupted authorities and criminals extort migrants every chance they get in violent countries on the way, namely Mexico. Many officials, cartels, and criminals are making a fortune by exploiting those seeking a better chance to live. We're now joined by Dr. Adrian Pine, a critical medical anthropologist who has worked in Honduras, Mexico, and Cuba, among others. She is also an author of her latest book, which is titled Asylum for Sale: Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Dr. Pine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know there are reports that children are being sexually abused and assaulted at the U.S. border. How do you think this could affect their future as well as the future of the American society?
Well, first of all, unaccompanied children are unaccompanied in large part right now because the United States government is denying their parents the right to seek asylum, the internationally guaranteed right to seek asylum. And so their parents are doing the only thing they can to save their children, which is to send them alone from the border, where you've got a lot of families together hoping to cross together, but since only their children are the ones who are allowed, they're sending them in by themselves. And then they're being immediately detained in what was supposed to be a shift from the Trump administration's quote-unquote kids in cages policy to something more humane.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Pine.
Among the new arrivals, there are many children still too young to grasp what it is that's happening to them. Unaware of what is going on, the children, many of whom are not even accompanied by any adults, are kept in overcrowded cages at the border facilities.
There were complaints that were filed with state agencies, and those complaints articulated very specific allegations about sexual assault on minors at this Freedman Center.
Currently, we have no basis for his call to shut down the San Antonio Freedman Coliseum as an intake site, but we will, of course, we take these allegations seriously, and they will be investigated.
It is one thing to report the suffering of children stuck at the border. It is another altogether to imagine the impact that the current situation would have on their future lives.
There are reports of sexual harassment of the kids, probably portraying only a glimpse of the reality of what is actually happening. But what is the root cause to the problem the U.S. is facing for decades? To have a better understanding of the situation, we've asked Dr. Aviva Chomsky to join us. She's a professor of history and the coordinator of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at the Salem State University. She's the author of The Undocumented: How Immigration Became Illegal. Welcome, Dr. Chomsky.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So, is there a plan in the Biden administration to tackle the issue through Washington's policies towards Central America?
Biden's plan for Central America follows that longstanding bipartisan consensus. It's a plan for security and prosperity in Central America. Now, those two words might sound good, but when you understand what they mean in the context of the United States and Central America, security means that the United States is going to continue to pour money into military and policing in Central America. Prosperity means that the United States is going to continue to impose upon Central America an economic model that's based on the privileging of foreign investment.
Currently, there is not enough space for children, and some facilities remain short on staff, at least according to some reports. Some kids are not eating enough food, and those infected with the coronavirus are not separated from the healthy ones. Texas has a dark history of abuse against migrant children. Sexual assaults and gang violence in Texas youth lockups was last brought to the spotlight in October 2020. when two justice and legal organizations sounded the alarm.
For more than a decade, the Texas Juvenile Justice Department has been associated with abuse of children and denying them their constitutional rights. So can we expect the situation to become better today?
Instead of ending the policy of kids in cages, as they named it, corporate Democrats and media, allied media alike, what we see is kids in quote-unquote overflow facilities that also are seeing human rights abuses, sexual abuses, children being deprived of their basic human rights, their basic hygienic needs, sunlight, showers. And so the media has quieted down, the corporate Democrats have quieted down. This really was more than anything a campaign issue to rile people up to vote for Biden, when in fact Biden is just as bad as Trump on the issue.
The recent spike in the number of new arrivals at the border has implications for both sides of the power play in the United States. After their loss in the 2020 presidential election, Republicans are resorting to any cards on the table in order to undermine the new Biden administration. The fate of children detained at the border is no different.
The Donna facility is a giant tent city. Built with a capacity of 250, it has nearly 4,000 people in it. We saw cages after cages after cages of little girls, of little boys, lying side by side, touching each other, covered with reflective emergency blankets. There was no 6-foot space, there was no 3-foot space, there wasn't a 3-inch space between the children lined up one after the other after the other.
Take Texas, which voted for former President Trump. With the new Democratic administration in the White House, Texas is locked in a battle with the federal government over the issue. Texas wants the kids out of the state to ensure safety, as Republican Governor Greg Abbott has said. The Texan conservatives would feel uncomfortable by the idea of open borders and an influx of refugees into the country, particularly as Trump had promised to solve the problem with a wall, which appears to have failed. But has anything really changed with President Biden in power?
Everybody has the right to request asylum, but that was the policy that Trump implemented. Now, when Biden became president, he said he was going to change that policy. Really, he's only changed one very small piece of it, which is that he's allowing unaccompanied minors who appear at the border to request asylum. Nobody else, not families with young children, nobody else. So he's only made one small change to the Trump policy, but there were many hundreds of children at the border who have been in squalid refugee camps on the street for weeks or months.
One of the key political figures at the center of the border crisis is Vice President Kamala Harris. Republican politicians and conservative-leaning media often target her, as she has been tasked with stemming the migration.
I've asked her, the VP today, because she's the most qualified person to do it, to lead our efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle and the countries are going to need help in stemming the movement of so many folks stemming the migration to our southern border.
Appointed as Biden's border point woman, Harris has still not visited the disaster zone, and that is the main argument brought up by Republicans. Roberta Jackson, President Biden's top official for border issues, is also stepping down after 100 days on the job. That has made the administration's task of handling the border crisis more challenging, as criticism is mounting. So, Dr. Pine, how do you assess the administration's effort to address the issue so far?
Well, the reports we're hearing from lawyers who have toured these facilities, as they have a legal right to do, is that children are being kept sometimes for 8 days without having the right to take a shower. They're being held without going outside. They're not given the right to contact their parents or their family members. These are inhumane conditions. These are conditions that I and many others consider to be torture. And frankly, they need to end. There's no excuse for this to be going on. And the Biden administration is hanging on to this argument that at least we're better than Trump and we're trying to change things, but there are a lot of things that they could do right now.
The president has been trying to house the migrant children in other states that are away from the border. Yet his initiative has not been successful everywhere. In Iowa, for example, the request has been rejected, and Governor Kim Reynolds has called the border crisis the president's problem.
First of all, I think this is an opportunity for two parties to sit down at the table and find a compromise. This is ridiculous. It's what we've done here in Iowa. We have figured out how two parties can work together and put Iowans first and move the ball forward and get something done. So there's no reason that they can't do it as well. And it's just ridiculous. And I think not only Iowans, but the American people are sick and tired of it. And there's a pretty easy compromise right there.
Today, Reynolds asserts that her priority is the health and safety of Iowans, and that the state does not have enough facilities to house migrant children. Under former President Trump, Reynolds ironically accepted migrants into the states, along with more than 30 other state governors. Yet the issue of immigration is not exactly Trump's fault, and has its roots in decades of atrocities against Central America.
And this is not just Trump policies, once again. This goes back to, for example, the Biden policy for Central America, which was implemented following the unaccompanied minor crisis of 2014 and involved the sending millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to massive development projects and militarized security aid to the Northern Triangle countries, which increased the vulnerability, it increased the violence, and it increased the concentration of wealth among the wealthiest, the oligarchs.
U.S. policies toward migrants has also created a crisis for Mexico. Mexico's border cities are not equipped to house, feed, and protect tens of thousands of refugees. Many of the cases of migrants forced to remain in Mexico ended with deportation orders from judges because they failed to show up for the immigration court hearing on the U.S. side of the border.
Are you a little nervous this morning? See? Do you understand what these proceedings here in court are all about? You know what a lawyer is? Sophia, good morning. Are you a little nervous this morning? See? Do you have a lawyer?
They have had to stay in places such as the Mexican state of Tamaulipas, where rape, torture, and kidnapping are so pervasive that the U.S. State Department itself has a do not travel advisory on. Yet the real humanitarian crisis could be ongoing, not in Mexico or at the U.S. border, but away from media cameras in Central America.
Well, here in the United States, unfortunately, we tend to see the humanitarian crisis only in terms of what's happening at the border. That is a humanitarian crisis, but the real humanitarian crisis is what's happening in Central America. Changing our immigration and border policies could relieve some of the crisis that's happening on the border, but to really change the roots of the crisis and where the crisis, the heart of the crisis, would mean to change our policies towards Central America. Now, Central American countries and people in Central America have tried over and over and over again to create their own independent path to development. The problem is that the United States intervenes every single time to overthrow those attempts to seek a different development model.
Since President Biden appeared in office, he has canceled some of Trump's restrictions against migrants. He is gradually admitting asylum seekers who enrolled in a program snubbed by the former president. Under Trump, the migrants had to wait in Mexico until their cases were processed in the United States. The January 2019 policy which was commonly known as the Remain in Mexico program, forced 71,000 migrants back into Mexico to file for asylum and wait for an indefinite amount of time.
Acá en espera es bastante peligroso.
It's quite dangerous because we're on the border. We're not from here, and danger is present all the time. So we put our hope in President Biden and everything he promised in his campaign. We hope he sticks to his promises.
For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. We are joined tonight by Jason Zubo. He's an immigration attorney, partner at Pilcher and Zubo PLLC, and a blogger at asylumist.com. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Let's jump right in. We want to discuss these latest sexual abuse allegations coming out of a child migration facility center in San Antonio, Texas. Where do these fit into the broader pattern of what's happening at the southern border?
Well, first, thank you for inviting me. You know, the latest allegations fit within the pattern that we've been seeing for years and years at the border. I mean, essentially, Governor Abbott said that there are sexual abuse of minor boys at a facility in Texas, and he's called upon that facility to be closed. You know, one issue that's sort of in the background of all this is the private prison industry, which basically incarcerates many of these immigrants who are coming to the United States and asking for political asylum. So these people are not criminals for the large majority. And they come here, they're seeking protection. Many of them are unaccompanied if they're children. And part of the reason for that is just the policy of allowing certain people into the United States who are unaccompanied minors, but if family units arrive or if adults arrive, they're immediately turned away under what's called 42, which is basically a rule that allows the federal government to turn away people at the border based on the public health emergency of coronavirus. So what you have is a situation of largely private prisons housing minors who often don't speak English, who don't know their rights, who are, of course, confused and scared, very vulnerable population. And so, you know, the governor's allegations, while they're not proven at all yet, do fit a pattern that we have seen, and there has been a problem with sexual abuse of immigrant detainees, not only at the border, but throughout the United States. It's really been an ongoing problem of the private prison industry, which, of course, is more concerned about the profits for their shareholders than it is about providing a safe environment for the detainees.
Well, it certainly seems that way. And Jason, you're someone who's worked for many years on asylum issues. So what can you tell us about the current outlook for those who come to the U.S. escaping conditions that, in many cases, it seems U.S. foreign policy is responsible for creating?
Well, there's all sorts of issues related to who is coming here because there are different populations. You know, on the one hand, we have this influx of people from Central America who are largely fleeing gang violence and domestic violence. Those aren't necessarily traditional asylum seekers like we think about political refugees or religious refugees, but they are people who face very severe danger. And if you take the time to talk to those people, you'll hear some pretty horrible stories, family members who are murdered, death threats, people who have been raped and sexually abused. So the harm they're suffering is very severe. And the issue for a lot of the Central Americans is that their harm doesn't easily fit within the framework for political asylum. So just because you face harm in your home country doesn't mean you can get asylum in the United States. You have to show that that harm is on account of your race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or particular social group. So those are the five protected categories. And so it's a little bit difficult sometimes to fit these Central American cases into a protected category. And for that reason, there's a pretty high denial rate for cases from Central America and Mexico, even though those people have suffered real harm. I mean, a lot of my clients are people from other countries, like we have journalists from Afghanistan and Pakistan, religious minorities from different countries in Africa. You know, we have LGBT asylum seekers who have many times been harmed in their home country by family members, among others. So the people who are coming here to seek protection are really a wide variety of people from all different countries around the world. The system, unfortunately, is a real disaster, not just at the border, which gets a lot of attention, but there's sort of a hidden asylum crisis, which is There are right now about 600,000 people in the affirmative asylum system. Some of those people have been waiting 5 and 6 years just to get an interview. Some of those people are separated from their family back home. They haven't seen their children in 5 years, 6 years, or more. There's also the immigration court system, which currently has about 1.3 million people waiting for hearings. And those people also, in many cases, have been waiting for years. So what you have is hundreds of thousands of people, many of whom have a real claim to protection under U.S. law and who we are committed to protecting. And I guess one last point I would mention, which you talked about the idea that some of our own policies have caused people to flee their countries. I mean, a very direct example of it are my clients who are working directly with the U.S. government as interpreters, translators, contractors in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, who have, because of their work with the U.S. and their association with the U.S., been threatened and attacked. Those people, you know, clearly have a valid claim for asylum, but there's also people where there's a more indirect problem. For example, Central America, where our policies, especially in the 1980s, encouraged these very right-wing and very brutal dictatorships. The problem of the drug war, with drugs coming up through Central America and weapons coming down from the United States, has created a climate of violence and impunity in many of these countries. And so, you know, I do think from a moral point of view, we have to think about honestly, what do we want to do for these people? Because they're, through no fault of their own in most cases, in a position where they face great harm, and sometimes we do bear some responsibility for putting them in that position.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Jason, for joining us tonight. We want to thank viewers at home for joining us as well. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
While in Mexico, many of the asylum seekers are targeted by criminal gangs and cartels. Many children are sexually abused or employed for dangerous crime. The dire conditions of the migrants have not become much better today, as they are reportedly allowed to stay in the U.S. That was our show. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javan Magi. Please tune in again next week when I come back with another episode of We the People.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Iran's civilian nuclear program has been under the spotlight recently. One of the scientific fields in which Iran made remarkable achievements in the years following the Islamic Revolution is nuclear engineering and science. But Iran's nuclear program is not restricted to the past years. It was launched in the 1950s. Under Iran's deposed Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the country launched a series of nuclear projects that relied on assistance from the United States and Europe. From 1974 through 1978, Iran was already carrying out nuclear research and education at the University of Tehran when the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, entered into force on March 5, 1970. The work centered on a 5-megawatt research reactor supplied by the United States, which began its operation in 1967. By the mid-70s, Iran had launched an extensive nuclear energy program. In 1974, Iran set the goal of producing roughly 23,000 megawatts of electric power from a series of nuclear power stations within 20 years. Iran was working on the nuclear fuel cycle, including plans for a new nuclear research center at Isfahan and the exploration of uranium mining and ore processing. Following the 1979 revolution, most international companies cut off the nuclear cooperation with Iran. But Iranian officials were determined to continue the country's nuclear development. However, the Iraq-imposed war on Iran hampered Tehran's efforts. The war, which began in 1980, consumed resources and damaged Iran's existing nuclear infrastructure. The two power reactors under construction at Bushehr were bombed several times, forcing officials to abandon the project. After the war ended, Iran's nuclear program was revived. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Iran held multiple negotiations with countries that could help the Islamic Republic in developing its technologies. Finally, Tehran managed to reach agreements with Russia, China, Pakistan, and France to build its first nuclear power plant. But the United States, which has long accused Iran of seeking to develop nuclear weapons, pressured potential suppliers to limit nuclear cooperation with Iran. As a result, China did not ultimately supply Iran with the research reactor, which was needed for plutonium production. Washington also blocked Iran's agreement with Argentina for uranium enrichment and heavy water production facilities. Meanwhile, in 1992, Russia and Iran signed a bilateral nuclear cooperation agreement. 3 years later, Russia announced that it would complete the construction of Bushehr's nuclear facility and agreed to build 3 additional reactors. The U.S. did not hesitate and stepped up its efforts to scale back Russian-Iranian nuclear cooperation. Despite all international pressures and bans, in the year 2000, when the scope of its nuclear program became clear, Iran had already made progress towards mastering the technology needed to make enriched uranium.
You see, we have a research reactor in Tehran, which is, the power of that reactor is about 5 megawatts. And it is dedicated mainly now for the production of radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals in general. Of course, it is also used for educational purposes and for research purposes.
Iran managed to build several nuclear facilities, including the Natanz Enrichment Complex, a heavy water production plant under construction at Arak. In 2003, the International Atomic Energy Agency carried out a number of facilities inspections and met with Iranian officials. In November of that year, the IAEA Board of Governors adopted a resolution welcoming Iran's decision to sign the additional protocol and to suspend enrichment. Iran has always again said that its nuclear program is peaceful and is aimed at generating electricity and producing radioisotopes to treat cancer patients. To this day, Iranian scientists have made remarkable progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology. Iran is now among 5 manufacturers of high-power lasers in the world. The Islamic Republic has also synthesized 42 new deuterated compounds that are used in the pharmaceutical industry and research. Getting to this level of independence and capabilities was not an easy task. In the 2000s, Iran was accused of pursuing to make a nuclear bomb, a claim that Iran has always rejected. In the years between 2007 to 2013, the UN Security Council passed 8 resolutions on Iran's nuclear program, calling on the Islamic Republic to halt its nuclear activities. The disputes between Iran and the West over its nuclear activities led to years of negotiations. And so on July 14, 2015, Iran signed a landmark nuclear deal with the P5+1 group, comprising of the US, the UK, France, China, Russia, and Germany. The agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, brought an end to the West's years-long dispute with Iran over the country's nuclear program. But when it came to the implementation stage, it was only Iran that completely stuck to the deal.
There is no need to renegotiate parts of the agreement because the agreement is concerning a nuclear program and, as such, it's delivering. We all agreed on the fact that there is no violation, that the nuclear programs, the nuclear program-related aspects, which is all the agreement, are being fulfilled.
The nuclear-related commitments undertaken by Iran under the JCPOA are being implemented. We will continue to implement the additional protocol in Iran, including carrying out complementary accesses to sites and other locations, as we do in other countries with additional protocols.
But the signatories did not fulfill the commitments, leading to a situation not changing for Iranians the way it was promised to. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally abandoned the accord, saying that it was defective and one-sided.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. In a few moments, I will sign a presidential memorandum to begin reinstating U.S. nuclear sanctions on the Iranian regime.
Since then, Washington has imposed a series of additional sanctions on Iranian entities and individuals, as well as foreign companies in Iran and some corporations outside of the country that do trade with Tehran. These sanctions have squeezed the country economically, infuriating many Iranians. After the U.S. pulled out of the agreement, Iran's leader, prior to the current negotiations, made his stance clear, like in this instance, in which he said the Islamic Republic could boost uranium enrichment to 60% if needed, defiantly vowing to not back down on the nuclear issue. Which brings us to Iran Nuclear Technology Day 2021. Many new achievements were unveiled on this day. The nuclear sectors revealed were mechanical, isotopes, radiation emergency, quantum physics, laser, and HF6 infiltration. For example, a new generation centrifuge assembly center at the Natanz facility was unveiled, including gas injections into IR6 and IR9 centrifuges. The second phase of industrial production of deuterium combinations, as well as a center for separation and application of stabilized isotopes, were also launched at the Fordow site.
Iran has been subject to verification since the JCPOA signing in 2015, and constant checks by the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, have verified 15 times that Iran has been in compliance with that deal. But the tables have turned. Iran got barely anything more than promises for its compliance. Now, it will return to full commitment only if the U.S. lifts sanctions off this country in one sweeping move. It has agreed to nothing else.
It may mean leaving with nothing for both sides, but Iran is adamant it's not going to get bitten again. It insists this time this country will be doing the verifying. It will verify sanctions have been lifted, and only then will it start reversing back into its nuclear commitments to the deal. So far, Iranian strategy has at least gotten the U.S. seriously thinking, even perhaps contemplating taking the first step to revive the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. I'm Leila Faramarzi. Iran's adamance in performing checks and balances before recommitting stems from a profound distrust for the U.S. The U.S. earned this distrust on several occasions, even before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when Iran and America were still fast friends. Mr. Abolfat is a political analyst, one of the best at national TV, so you can imagine his all-round detailed vision of matters in his domain. Let's hear his take at Press TV Studios.
Would things have been any different if the Shah were in place, the friend of America? Because even then, they wouldn't have allowed us nuclear technology.
There have been many indicators that the Americans were taking measures to prevent Iran from acquiring peaceful nuclear technology. Americans themselves did not engage with Iran, but the Germans signed a contract to build the Bushehr power plant. They did their utmost to ensure that Iran wouldn't advance past a certain point. Evidence suggests if it wasn't for the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Americans wouldn't let Iran acquire peaceful nuclear technology.
Mr. Izadi is professor of international studies. He often comes up with the unexpected, but with logical reason attached. It was worth the trek out into center-west Tehran.
What lessons would you say Iran's JCPOA experience with the U.S. has borne for the world?
The point that Biden and people like Antony Blinken were making before they got into office about Trump leaving the agreement is actually true. That if countries realize that you make an agreement with one administration, and once that administration leaves, the agreement is nullified by the next administration, no one is going to be able to make any agreements with the United States. So U.S. says that it's an important country, but when it comes to international agreements, it acts like a banana republic.
Even before the Trump administration's reimposition of secondary sanctions in May 2018, after they unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal, Iran was not receiving the full benefits of sanctions relief. The main impediment was that major banks were reluctant to facilitate transactions or provide financing for Iran-linked projects. So most major deals signed with a vision of the JCPOA working hit a roadblock. Iran had placed orders for Boeing and Airbus aircraft, had attempted joint ventures with automakers Peugeot and Renault and Daimler. It had struck energy deals with Total and CNPC and rail projects with Siemens and Alstom. But even before Trump, a shady Republican, was elected to office, they lost faith in the nuclear deal and Iran's economic stability. As expected, they thought it too risky to venture into Iranian waters. Mr. Ajorlu is editor-in-chief of Mosallas magazine. He generously welcomed us to review and weigh the JCPOA's chances with us.
You see, in the past 4 or 5 years, Europe has talked about INSTEX and the revival of the JCPOA. Mr. Rouhani downplayed the importance of the matter, saying that the P5 plus 1 has turned to P4 plus 1. But we don't look at the issue optimistically. In the past 2 or 3 years, we have witnessed the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Mr. Fakhrizadeh. There has also been the recent incident at Natanz. We can't take these lightly just because we are negotiating with Europe. Europe is basically powerless.
Former U.S. President Trump renewed Iran's distrust in 2018, not just by pulling out of the deal and comically reimposing U.N. sanctions.
As Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif put it, the U.S. had imposed, reimposed, or relabeled some 1,600 sanctions on Iran, inflicting $1 trillion worth of direct and indirect economic damage on this country. In fact, Trump's scorched-earth sanctions policy has done everything to make it impossible for President Biden to return to the JCPOA. At least, that's what it aimed for.
We don't know if Biden wants to, because Biden generally belongs to the right wing of the Democratic Party. He's very close to the Israelis, and whether he wants to go back to JCPOA is very much in doubt.
If there's any chance the JCPOA can be brought up to speed with what was intended, Iran will make sure that actually happens. Sanction lifting has to happen in action, in practice, and not just on paper. And sanction lifting verification will take time. Parliament estimates 3 to 6 months. And it insists verification has to be continual, for example, once every 6 months, in order to make sure Iran's economic interests, financial interests, are being secured. Barack Obama, America's signing president himself, said the deal was not built on trust, but verification of compliance. So Iran was under constant surveillance by the IAEA. Now, Iran expects to do the surveillance. One option might be to establish a new panel of experts or special rapporteur at the United Nations, responsible for gathering, interpreting, and assessing evidence on the implementation of sanctions relief. There's always talk of the IAEA confirming Iran's conformity with the JCPOA. Can we create no council, international council, to keep an eye on other parties to the deal?
Unfortunately, this is the bitter reality of the international system. We aren't dealing with a just system. The great powers abuse their authority and follow international law wherever it's politically expedient and disregard it when it's not to their benefit. There's a lack of a higher authority to prosecute those countries. Of course, there's an international court of justice and criminal court, but Americans often do not comply with their rulings.
What would verification mean? It means Iran must be able to sign contracts, export oil, and bring in the revenues via banking channels or find other uses for them. Let's not forget, the JCPOA was intended to boost Iran's economy and foreign trade relations in return for this country limiting its nuclear program, which it has maintained is for peaceful purposes.
I think we certainly can regain our power by taking an appropriate approach and analysis of the regional issues. But today, the Iranian people are feeling psychological and economic insecurities. This is the result of believing that dealing with the U.S. will solve all the problems. They tried it out and realized that it wasn't possible. Didn't Mr. Biden say he would return to the JCPOA once he takes office? Why hasn't he returned? Why is he saying he won't resume full compliance until Iran does? We have the experience of drawing up a legal contract and signing and verifying it. But after all that, they might tear the agreement apart someday. There is no guarantee in place whatsoever.
Why the United Nations to establish such a verification mechanism? Some reasons are, first, the nuclear deal is enshrined in United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. That obligates promoting and facilitating the development of normal economic and trade contacts and cooperation with Iran. Second, the IAEA, a United Nations agency, is already involved in verifying half of the nuclear deal's quid pro quo. Third, Iran has itself turned to United Nations bodies to say file a suit at the International Court of Justice against the U.S. for not holding its end of the bargain with the JCPOA. Fourth, the issue of sanctions relief impacts Iran's relationships with the wider international community. I'm talking non-JCPOA countries that wouldn't want to raise their concerns at a forum dominated by the U.S. Non-partial countries that share economic interests with Iran and cannot afford the blow of secondary U.S. sanctions imposed on dealing with Iran are countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and North Korea.
As a matter of fact, this is how we should speak to the people. We must explain that our attempts at establishing ties with the West have hurt us. We have shown goodwill to the West, Europe, US, Russia, and China, but the upshot was more sanctions on the oil and banking sectors, yet we remain committed to the agreement. More importantly, there have been a few terror attacks, both against our high-ranking officials and our nuclear sites. In my opinion, we need to send the messages through political, military, and security means. We can't stop at the political level. We can define new relations on an international level.
The insurance and shipment of Iranian oil tankers, as well as the global money transfer SWIFT mechanism, are among Iran's top priorities in securing oil sales and incoming petrodollars. It is being discussed what should be done regarding Iran's technical commitments and how they be carried out in case a party falls short on their promise. This, Kazem Gharibabadi said of the early April nuclear talks in Vienna. Gharibabadi is Iran's ambassador to the UN's nuclear watchdog and a delegation member to the said Vienna talks, at which Iran explored options to prevent a potential repeat of what happened in 2018. That is when Donald Trump binned the nuclear deal and yet expected to have a say in its implementation.
When they say you come and talk to us, what they actually mean is that you come and give us more concessions, give us more stuff. And Iran is not interested in doing that because the concessions that Iran gave last time resulted in almost nothing for Iran. So why would you want to sit down with the same people that you gave them concessions before and they didn't do much?
Plenty more to be said, but first a quick look at other media outlets to see what others have to say on our affairs. Here's what they actually say in words. Mehr News makes a mention of Iran's eastern partners to the JCPOA who want to help bring the deal up to scratch. Moscow doing its utmost to find solution to JCPOA revival. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said he accepts the U.S. State Department's assessment of the process, which it described as difficult. Firstly, because there is no trust between Tehran and Washington, and obviously there can be no such trust. That is why it is very difficult to reach any agreement. Second, actions need to be verified, which is a very sensitive and complex issue. Even without this, the process is very difficult because there is so much deviation from the initial characteristics of the JCPOA that returning to the original state requires great political will, the Russian official said. We've got Reuters that quotes the French foreign minister on how tactical problems and Iranian politics are hindering revival of nuclear talks. France's foreign minister said the efforts to revive nuclear talks with Iran were being held up by tactical problems and the domestic situation in Iran ahead of its presidential election in June. There's a tactical problem and also an internal issue in Iran, which is in a particular situation because we are quite close to the presidential election in June. This, Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told a hearing at the French Senate. He did not say what the tactical problem was, but added that while there was a stated will to return to talks, tensions remained, and it was urgent to move forward to calm the situation. Iran's Tasnim News says how time matters. Dragging feet on Iran sanctions removal, ruining chances of JCPOA revival, said the spokesman for the Iranian administration. He warned the violators of the 2015 nuclear deal that procrastination in lifting the sanctions against Tehran would ruin the opportunity for the revival of the accord. Speaking at a press conference, Ali Rabi advised the violators of the JCPOA to seize the opportunity to salvage the nuclear deal by terminating sanctions on Iran. They should know that every day of further delay in lifting the sanctions against Iran will only dim the chances of revival of the JCPOA as the first and last solution available for putting aside the differences, but also push them away from a better prospect for relations with Iran, he warned.
The spokesperson also made it clear that the only logical option for the U.S. administration is to rejoin the JCPOA and fully end the sanctions on Iran. And that would be it for this section. Do stay tuned.
As the Vienna nuclear talks proceeded, Iran did say it was in no hurry for results. Results are what it is looking for, but if the U.S. must lose time, Iran will carry on with enriching uranium to levels higher than that stipulated in the nuclear deal. That's to say, it is producing and storing enriched uranium with a 20% purity level, breaking the 3.67% enrichment parameter set by the deal. Iran might even go up to 60% purification if the country needs it.
Would you say Israel might achieve its goal? Can it put a spanner in the works with Iran's talks with JCPOA partners?
Obviously, it's this type of terrorist action is not going to stop Iran's nuclear program. As you saw, Dr. Salehi, the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, said that they are building facilities inside the mountains near Natanz, near the current nuclear site. Israel is actually making Iran's nuclear program stronger.
Sunday, 11th April, the electrical grid of the Natanz nuclear site was disrupted. This coincided with the anniversary of the National Day of Nuclear Technology in Iran, and during this country's efforts to push the West into lifting sanctions. Bit of a coincidence, given disruption at Natanz has been one of the methods of sabotage in this strategic facility for many years. Only last July, a mysterious explosion shook the plant. Also on Tuesday, as Vienna talks began to revive U.S. participation in the JCPOA, an Iranian vessel stationed in the Red Sea was damaged by an apparent Israeli mine attack. With such bad will in Iran's backyard, the U.S. will have to try that much harder to rekindle the deal.
You know, the Israelis have been saying this for some time, that in order to slow down Iran's nuclear program, or in order to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, you don't have to give Iran concessions. You don't have to negotiate with Iran. You don't need to go to Vienna. You can just destroy things. You can engage in terrorism. You can kill Iranian scientists. You can blow up Iranian nuclear sites.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, in his weekly press briefing on Monday, April the 12th, hinted that Israel might be behind Natanz nuclear plant incident, which happened the day before the presser. He elaborated on the sabotage in Natanz nuclear facility in central Iran, saying that many sources link the sabotage operation to the Israeli regime, which had frequently threatened to run such operations against Iran. This is not going to impact Iran's nuclear capability. All centrifuges unplugged were of the old IR-1 type and will be replaced by advanced machines. Iran is not going to be trapped. The Israeli regime takes revenge on Iranian people for their patience and sage behavior. Iran would take revenge in appropriate time.
It's typical of the Israeli regime to commit assassinations and acts of sabotage and refuse to assume responsibility for them. Their media, however, report that it was their doing. Our security institutions also know who the culprit has been. There must be a reciprocal action, or else our silence might send a bad signal to them.
There's no touching between Iran and America. Even with the Vienna talks, Iran refrained from indirect talks even. How it went is that the 4+1 states spoke separately to Iranian and to American representatives and brought the results to each of the two separately.
The U.S. talks tough, but it's willing to hold even long-distance talks with Iran to get back into the JCPOA one way or another. Can you comment on that, please?
Last week, we had Republican senators, members of the House, writing a letter to Biden that whatever agreement you will have with Iran, it's going to end once we go back to the White House. And they may go back to the White House in 2024. Who knows whether Biden is going to get reelected or he's going to be alive, or, you know, we don't know. So that's another criteria in Iranian leaders' calculation.
Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted, the aim of the meeting would be to rapidly finalize sanction lifting and nuclear measures for choreographed removal of all sanctions, followed by Iran seizing remedial measures. No Iran-US meeting, unnecessary, he added. Even Western European parties to the deal couldn't or wouldn't do much to find a way around US sanctions to fulfill their trade commitments to Iran under the deal. So, Iran decided to give them time in inching out of its commitments one step at a time, whilst at the same time finding a way around sanctions itself. Fellow Easterners have cooperated in the process, and Iran is still selling oil.
Iran's definite stance for return to JCPOA is that the U.S. remove all sanctions, once and for all. How did Iran come to this distrust for the U.S.?
You see, Donald Trump was warned against the same things when he was trying to carry out his threats. Many warned the then U.S. administration that its maximum pressure campaign wouldn't necessarily work. Iran has been under sanctions for over 40 years and has mastered ways to circumvent them. Many countries are now unwilling to side with the U.S. The international system has been different at the start of the third decade of the current century compared to the first decade.
To China, Iran has been exporting oil openly up to over a million barrels a day, reportedly. And late March, it even signed a 25-year accord with China to cover any and all economic and infrastructural aspects of cooperation, as well as military cooperation. This has been much to the dismay of the West and Israel, hence verbal and practical sabotage of the Sino-Iranian agreement. Proponents say Iran will benefit from turning east, while critics say Iran may be giving up too much in its quest to boost ties with China. Not really. Iran just has to be alert to details, such as the importance of Chinese companies employing also Iranians at all levels.
Given what you say and the fact that Iran has found some ways around sanctions, what means of pressure have remained for the West?
You see, the U.S. elite is acknowledging this in their media. Just a few days ago, there was an article in the New York Times warning that the Biden administration didn't have many options available to it anymore. It said the so-called maximum pressure campaign hasn't worked, and Iran has increased its nuclear capacity both qualitatively and quantitatively. The American elite is claiming, based on their interpretation of Tehran's capacities, that Iran is on the verge of building a nuclear weapon. Therefore, they argue that U.S. needs to enter into an agreement with Iran as soon as possible.
In all, early April saw Iranian crude production rise in the latest months, hitting 2.14 million barrels a day in February, and that's according to the latest S&P Global Platts survey of the OPEC output. OPEC stands for Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. To end with a taste of the mood in Iran's governing circles, the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said, I've heard some Americans say today's situation is different from when JCPOA was signed in 2015-2016, and some JCPOA articles must be changed. That's true. During this time, a government took office in the U.S. that disgraced and humiliated the U.S., but Iran has earned more power and reinvigorated. So, if a change is to be made, it should be to the benefit of Iran.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Don't forget to tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as our narrative is ongoing. Bye for now.
IRIB English Radio.